WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
This year, Millennium Park celebrates its 20th birthday. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's no secret that Chicagoans and tourists alike love Millennium Park, especially during the summer months. But it wasn't always such an oasis. In fact, it used to be a parking lot. And before that, the land it sits on didn't even exist. Today on the podcast, we dive into the fascinating history of Millennium Park and how it became what it is today. I sat down with Loyola Chicago history professor and author of Millennium Park, Creating a Chicago Landmark, Tim Guilfoyle. Tim starts in 1837, the year that Chicago became a city, with what the space now known as Millennium Park looked like.
Well, at that time, it was just water. And in many ways, you can look at the space that we call Millennium Park today and much of Grant Park as a history lesson, that it represents the history of Chicago writ small. It was originally water, mm-hmm. Lake Michigan. Then it was created really in the mid-19th century, first with the introduction of the rail line of the Illinois Central Railroad, which came in on the lake roughly 300 feet or 100 yards off what was then Michigan Avenue, and effectively representing the history of 19th century Chicago being shaped by the railroad. And then after the Great Fire, much of the lagoon between the rail and Lake Michigan was filled in. That was the beginning, really, of Grant Park. Mm-hmm. And then eventually Grant Park was created in the early 20th century in bits and pieces. Much of Grant Park was devoted to parking by the middle part of the 20th century. In fact, it had the nation's largest outdoor municipal park by the middle part of the 20th century, what's today just to the east of Millennium Park.
Right.
And then it had a number of underground garages. So again, the history of the automobile and its impact on Chicago, replacing the railroad in importance. And then much of the space that is occupied by Millennium Park today, which had been a rail yard, was turned over into a parking lot that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And it remained that way into the 1990s. It was often used by rail executives who would park their car in that space and then walk over to the high-rises in the loop to their offices.
Interesting.
And then at the end of the 20th century, largely through the initiative of Mayor Daley and others, they wanted to turn that space, they wanted to finish Grant Park, turn mm-hmm. that space into public usage. And eventually came up with the idea for Millennium Park.
Yeah, and we'll dig into some of those later moments. But just sticking to the beginning for a moment, I do also want to note, Tim, that the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi say that this land is unceded, right? The tribe co-signed the 1833 Treaty of Chicago, giving up their land to the shores of Lake Michigan. It's a case that the tribe ultimately lost in the Supreme Court. Anything else you can share just about that part of the history?
There was a number of treaties prior to the founding of Chicago, the Treaty of St. Louis in 1816, the first Treaty of Chicago, 1821, and then the final treaty in 1833 that was largely a result of the war with the Fox and Sac Indian tribes that effectively eliminated or removed, some would say ethnically cleansed, Native Americans from what is today Chicago. So mm-hmm. the Pokagon tribe technically has a legitimate claim in that the space that is now Millennium Park or Grant Park at large didn't exist in 1833.
Right.
The line effectively was where Michigan Avenue is today. Everything to the east of Michigan Avenue is effectively landfill. So probably by the terms, I've never read the treaty, but probably by the terms of the treaty that they're describing, they do have a claim, but the Supreme Court has ruled otherwise.
Getting back to the 20th century, it became quite an eyesore at that point, as you mentioned. When was it that people started discussing the idea of just changing the lakefront? And talk about that famous story involving Mayor Richard M. Daley that sort of finally prompted him to push this transformation.
Sure, sure. There's several stories. Perhaps the most interesting, it might be somewhat apocryphal, is that Mayor Daley used to go to his dentist in a high rise along Michigan Avenue, and he would look out the window and he would see this ugly eyesore of a parking lot on what is now the site of Millennium Park. It was the one part of Grant Park that hadn't been finished. It, as I mentioned, it had originally been a rail yard. By the 1960s, the Illinois Central had stopped using it for most cases. The Metro line continued to operate in that space. And in fact, I was told that ultimately it was so little used by the Illinois Central that they just ran a rail car once a year on the track to demonstrate that they owned the property. And then because of a series of fortuitous circumstances, largely related to the larger Chicago economy, city officials realized they could build a parking structure in that space that would service Soldier Field. So ironically, Soldier Field played a role in the creation of Millennium Park. And the idea was they could float bonds that would pay for the parking structure and it would be affordable, and they would be able to pay off the bonds in a short period of time. Once that was completed, or once the idea for that was completed, Daley wanted to put a park on top of the roof of that parking structure. And at that point, he reached out to John Bryan, then the CEO of Sara Lee, an individual who had raised over $100 million for the CSO, the Chicago Symphony, and the Lyric Opera, a great fundraiser with connections to the philanthropic community, the corporate community. He had been chairman of the board at the University of Chicago, so he had all these cultural connections that made it fortuitous for him to raise money. So Daley appealed to him to privately raise money for the park. Daley did not want to spend public money on the park. He felt that that would potentially lead to his defeat in a mayoral election because Chicagoans don't like to be taxed, like most Americans.
But he eventually gets the ball rolling.
He gets the ball rolling, and he originally asked Bryan for to raise $30 million. And Bryan, after the meeting with an aide, got back in his car and he told the aide, "We're not going to raise $30 million. We're going to raise at least $60 million." And by the time it was over, he had raised roughly $260 million. So,
well, we've dug into the archives, Tim. We found audio of people sharing their thoughts about the park just as it opened. So this is from WBEZ's talk show 848 with Steve Edwards back in July of 2004.
I think the Millennium Park looks amazing. I think the fact that it's for the public is brilliant, and obviously a lot of big investment, but I think well worthwhile.
Well, it really is nice to have the little sitting areas that you can use now. I mean, it's in walking distance where before it was always a hike. I think it's worth the money from what I see.
I think it was a waste of money. I just like that big ugly thing right there. What did they spend the money for? What is it?
The Manchel. It's what impresses me now. Wish I could get closer. Looks like it's going to be something.
Oh yeah, it's gorgeous. I didn't even know they had it down here. Seems like it'll have a lot of uses for it.
It's getting really nice. I came last year and it was nothing like looked like this. So I think there is going to be really, really nice.
I like it. Love it.
So far, I love it. I think it's outstanding.
It's pretty cool, like this exhibit with all the families and stuff. But that jelly bean thing, it's kind of ugly. It's just ugly.
It's great. Yeah, it's really very cool. This fountain's really pretty.
And the whatever that is.
I like it.
So you and I both chuckling throughout that because, of course, we hear a mixed bag of comments. Some people really, really liked it. Some people confused. What is this?
Yeah.
It's ugly.
Well, that was pretty representative of the initial reactions. And even before the park was finally constructed and opened, there was a whole series of controversies surrounding the construction of the park and the funding of it and whether or not Daley had made a Faustian bargain by ceding so much power, so much influence, so much decision-making to the private sector over what was effectively public space.
But I got to ask you the question on everyone's minds. What is the deal with the Bean, Tim? Well, what was the vision there?
So that space...
Or the Jelly Bean, as they called it in the clip.
That space was the product of a committee. So a little bit of background might be helpful here. The park was divided into sections, SALs, if you use the original term for Grant Park, that were effectively amenities. And John Bryan went to various corporations and prominent historic Chicago families and asked them to contribute to some part of the park in this one amenity to make a substantial donation, usually from $3 to $15 million. Those were the basic price points for the different amenities in the park. And this included a fountain feature, a band shell, a peristyle, a garden.
Yes.
That space was supposed to be the garden. Jeff Koons was actually supposed to submitted a proposal. And to make a long story short, members of the committee didn't like the proposal. The sculpture by Anish Kapoor, the Bean, or Cloud Gate, as it's formally known, was originally going to be in the space where the garden is today, in Lurie Garden. And they decided to move that object, this is all in the planning station, hadn't even been constructed yet, over to the space above the railroad tracks and above the rink. And at that point, it just gave more prominence to the Anish Kapoor sculpture. They originally had hoped to build the sculpture in Oakland, put it on a boat, go through the Panama Canal, come up to the St. Lawrence Seaway, through the Great Lakes, come over to Queens Landing, put it on a truck, and drive it over to Millennium Park. But they were worried that once they put it on the truck, that it was so heavy, 110 tons, that it would break Lakeshore Drive.
Oh, wow.
So what they ended up doing was constructing it halfway in Oakland, then numbering all the parts, taking it apart, and then bringing the parts, it's 110 panels, to Chicago, and then reconstructing it on site in Chicago.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're just about out of time, but you literally, as I mentioned, you wrote the book on Millennium Park. So I got to ask, in your opinion, in these 20 years since it's opened, would you say that it's done what it set out to do?
Sure. It's one of the most popular, some would say the most popular tourist attraction in Chicago. It gets at least 5 million visitors a year.
Yeah.
I've seen figures as high as 13 million. So it really only competes. The only competitor for it is Navy Pier, where we're sitting right now. I think for the most part, most Chicagoans do like the park. There's something in it for everybody. It provides a range of activities. It's a 12-month-a-year space that you can use. Timuel Black, the late Chicago activist and historians, once said that this was the gathering ground, has become the gathering ground of Chicagoans in the 21st century. If you just go to Crown Fountain almost any day of the week in the summer.
Oh, yeah. It's a popular spot.
A mixture of children of all races, all ages, all over the metropolitan area coming into Grant Park. So there aren't many spaces like that in Chicago. So I think for the most part, it has been.
It's a success. Yeah. We've been talking with Loyola history professor Timothy Guilfoyle. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Sasha.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Jules Yeager, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. Want to learn more about Chicago's history and news? Well, make sure to sign up at wbez.org/resetnews for our daily newsletter. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.